Hello there. Welcome to Semester 8, Episode 2 of the IBY's Just Admitted podcast, where former deans and directors of admission give expert insight into the complex college admissions landscape. This season, what are my chances? Data and decisions in college admissions. We're looking at statistics, data, and other kinds of evidence to help listeners decide what to consider and what to move past. I'm Tasha, your host. I'm an admissions counselor at IBYWISE, a former international admissions officer at USC, and a former assistant director of international admissions at Boston University. Today, my guest is Kimberly. Hi, Kimberly.
Hey, Tasha. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can you introduce yourself?
Absolutely. My name is Kimberly, and I am a former assistant director of admission at Rice University, a former senior associate director of admission at Vassar College, and also an IBYWISE counselor.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Kim. So I'm so excited to have you on today to really kind of sink into the theme of this season, which is really all about data and chances and numbers and all these factors that I think are really, really present in the college admissions landscape and application process for students and parents these days. So today, our topic is admissions data is everywhere, but what matters? All right, so we're going to be looking at resources out there where students can find data and information about college admissions, but mainly we're going to be looking at what is that data, right? What numbers are we even talking about when we refer to data when it comes to college admissions? So what kind of data are we referring to?
Well, I think what we're going to talk about today really falls into two different buckets. And so first, there's going to be any kind of data that you really can find on an admitted student college profile. So these are profiles that exist on various schools' websites, or you might be able to find them through Google on third-party websites that collect college statistics, or often in a lot of the printed materials or emails that colleges send out. Additionally, too, the other bucket is thinking about statistics from the high school side. And so these are often stats that are available on a high school profile for a specific school, or again, might be available on their own website or potentially on also some third-party websites that might be out there, too.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And I think, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit more, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say, Kim, but I think that the statistics on a college's website, you know, you have to make sure they've been updated, but they are definitely, you know, the most reliable. And I think, you know, folks like IBYWISE and other kind of counselors, you know, your high school counselors are definitely going to be using those numbers carefully as part of the way that they'll advise you. And so it's important to remember, like, you know, go to the source when possible. So let's go kind of one by one, since we have lots of different kinds of data. So the first here is admit rates or admission rates. This is the percentage that, you know, you're probably most familiar with when you're looking up different colleges and universities. There's usually a number that pops up on Google or pops up on a rankings list or wherever it is that you're looking. And that number has a lot to do with the way that we talk about selectivity, right? So it's the percent of students who are admitted out of the pool that applies, right? So that makes sense. You know, the lower that number, the more selective. But the percent admitted in each different kind of admission round actually varies widely. So the number that you see published is usually for regular decision, or sometimes it might be a combination of all of the admission rounds and kind of the average percent admission rate. Usually it's just regular decision. So it's important to note that the other admission rounds, like early decision two, early action, usually have higher admission rates. There's lots of reasons for that. And you can definitely check back out the just admitted episodes about early decision, early action. We also have lots of blog articles that go deeply into that. But just to note that that admission rate may not be wholly representative of the kinds of selectivity that that college might offer depending on the round where you apply. Then are there certain types of applicants that may inflate or deflate admit numbers? So like athletes, merit scholarship program students, and direct admit programs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the fascinating thing about admit rates is that it's a really easy and straightforward number to just glom onto. But as you're already sort of explained, Tasha, it's actually really nuanced as to what that number represents. And so oftentimes that overall admit rate is not really giving you a good picture of what's happening behind the scenes. So as you mentioned, the different rounds can really impact that overall number. But also, yes, there are different kinds of applicants that might be within a pool for a specific school that could also potentially be impacting that. So, for example, if it's a school that has really strong athletic programs, and so potentially a D1 institution, for example, a lot of times those athletes have already been pre-screened for admission. And so they're pretty much guaranteed by the time that they actually apply that they are going to receive an acceptance. And so those numbers in any of the various rounds of a pool might impact admit rates for a particular school. Likewise, too, schools that have really strong merit scholarship programs oftentimes will auto-admit those students as well. And so that can also sort of inflate an admit number for compared to students who might just be applying through the general pool. And likewise, too, one of the things that's happened in the last few years, which is something you could discuss in a future episode, is this idea of direct admit programs. And so schools that are identifying students that have particular numbers or are coming from particular demographic categories and offering direct admission. And so likewise, too, these are students who are not necessarily applying directly to the institution, but are receiving an offer of acceptance without that. And so when you're thinking about yourself as someone who might be applying, that could be a category that likewise would also be changing what that overall admit rates looks like for you as a general student.
So there is so much nuance to that number that you see for percent admission. That said, you know, it's definitely an important number to keep in mind as like a general marker of a school selectivity, but always keeping in mind all of the nuance. And one of the big factors that creates that nuance is the difference in admit rates between individual programs within a college or university. So for example, the Questrom School of Business at Boston University's admit rate versus the admit rate at the College of Arts and Sciences. Most colleges and universities do not necessarily post or publicize that difference, but that difference does exist. Kim, what do you know about that? And do you agree? I haven't really seen it public.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a really important thing to be able to tease out about admission rates as well. I know you mentioned Boston University. I also think of a place like the University of Washington, for example, where their overall admission rate versus their admission rate for computer science are dramatically different. And you're right. A lot of times schools aren't necessarily posting these numbers, but if you are able to find them, or if you're at least able to keep in mind as to what some of those most popular programs may be, that's obviously something to really consider when you're thinking about overall admission rate. The other, you mentioned business, I mentioned computer science. The other programs that can often have varying admission rates too are those that are going to be really high resource. And oftentimes you can find these admission rates a little bit more readily than you might for just sort of general popular programs. So for example, I'm most specifically referring to nursing, which is always sort of a limited resource program. And so there's usually a finite number of spots that they're able to admit. And so oftentimes if you're applying for a program like that, that is going to be much more limited in admission, you can be able to find those rates versus what the overall admission rate might be.
Yeah, that's a great point about limited resource programs. And I think, it's true for programs like nursing, where it's something, super technical and practical and necessary. And there's, a lot of demand for more, quality nurses. But then, just as much like something like computer science, where there's so much interest and demand, which just kind of creates like the ultimate competition, really. Programs are getting larger and trying to accommodate that, but not maybe as fast as the interest is increasing. The next factor is the college admissions rate for graduating students from your particular high school. So this is something that you might not have thought of. It's not something that you're necessarily talking about with your peers. Like, hey, do you know how many students from last year went to college or were admitted to this particular school. But, that can really affect the your particular percent, your particular chances depending on your school profile and kind of the history of admissions to a particular college from your high school. So colleges use that admission rate as an indicator of the strength of the academic program. It can also be a sign of attitudes to higher education in the community. So, you know, if it's like a particular school that, you know, tends to have like a strong pipeline, so to speak, from your high school, you know, that can affect things, but not necessarily for the better. There is some nuance to this as well, Kim, and I'm wondering if you can help us kind of tease that out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've identified a couple of really important things within this. It is a number when I was on the college side that we paid pretty close attention to, because there is a difference between a student who's going to a high school where only 20% of the students in that particular school may be continuing on to higher education versus a school where 80% plus may be applying on. So it provides additional context to really understand, again, kind of what the academic offerings might be at the school. But then also, too, I think this idea of barriers is really important as well. If a student's at a school where only 20% are going on to college, there's probably a fair amount of overcome for them to be really able to choose to pursue that path for themselves when it's not something that's prevalent within the greater community. And likewise, too, if a student's at a school where there might be 80% of their peers are going to on to higher education, then that can really sort of show what level of competition the student might be up against, the variety of classes that they might be able to take, and again, just sort of like the expectations that might be generally on them, you know, both through family, through community, and certainly within the school itself. So this is one of those things that I think, like you're saying, is not always something students are thinking about or even know exists. But we started out talking about the two sort of separate buckets of information and where you can find them. And this is one of those pieces of information that always is going to exist on a school profile, which any student out there can absolutely ask their guidance office, their school counseling office, their college counseling office to see what that document looks like. And you often can find those numbers too online somewhere as well. So it's nice to know, just to understand your high school and understand some of the demographics as a student heads into this process.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, always with the caveat of not getting bogged down by these numbers or necessarily seeing a number and thinking like, oh man, I think that really, you know, disqualifies me. Like, no, there's always so many other factors at play. And I think, you know, when it comes to your particular high school, I think that's when really consulting with your counselor is really important. So definitely good to keep in mind. All right. So the next, I think, is kind of getting away from specificity and kind of more broad in terms of the kinds of numbers that you would see when you're looking at colleges and universities at a glance. You know, if you're Googling them, if you're looking at rankings, if you're looking at general school profiles, college profiles, this comes up a lot and is very important to think about and think about its nuance. So the middle 50%, we're talking about both standardized test scores and GPA. And I think, you know, as college admissions professionals, Kim, we throw around the middle 50% all the time. And I think sometimes I take for granted what that means. Like, does that, for someone who's never heard of middle 50%, like what is that, right? Like, and I find myself struggling to explain it sometimes. I'm like, well, if you think of 100% and then you think of the middle, maybe you could do a better job. Can you help me out?
I hope, maybe. Yeah, so the middle 50%, like you said, so if we're looking at the whole 100% scale, these are the scores that fall between the 25th percentile and the 75th percentile on that 100 point scale there. And so, for example, we know SAT scores are out of 1600. And so a school might say that the middle 50%, so the 25th percentile for students who are admitted, is a 1310. And the 75th percentile is a 1420. And so that would be the range that falls between that middle 50% there. And yes, it is something that we do talk about, and we talk about in terms of GPA as well. I think that they are also helpful numbers, but things that are not to get bogged down by as well, for a couple of really important reasons, particularly with test scores now. Of course, the last few years with test optional has made that landscape look really different, and those numbers look really different as well in terms of their utility in the process. And frankly, it's because you have to really tease out for a school, particularly if they're test optional, how many students are actually applying to that school with a test score. And then for admitted students, if that's what they're reporting out, how many of their admitted students or how many of their class actually submitted those test scores as well. So for example, if you're looking at a school and they're showing this middle 50% and it's, you know, a 1400 to a 1500, say, but then you read that only 30% of their applicant pool actually submitted test scores. And so therefore, that can probably tell you there was some selection happening there. And so students were really being cautious about submitting test scores. And so probably those test scores have skewed a little bit higher than they might have in previous years. So that's one of those things to keep in mind. I think in general guidance also, as we know, we really advise our students if they're not hitting the upper end of that middle 50%. So if they're not really hitting sort of close to that 75%, and for a test optional school, at least, then that's a score that I would probably tell my students not to submit. But Tasha, I would love to hear if you have different guidance on that.
Yeah, I think it's tough, especially right now. We're recording this in late February 2024. And, you know, it's coming out in a couple weeks that there's been a lot of change and news around this particular topic. So, a few colleges have announced that they're now going to be requiring standardized test scores to be submitted, which is a big change from 2020. And, you know, these universities are definitely kind of like leaders in the space that may, you know, influence others following suit. So that's yet to be determined. We will see in the next few months. You know, hopefully they will give students ample time to decide. But I think it's tricky. You know, I agree that for the most part, if students are not toward the top of the middle 50%, they should consider going test optional. At the same time, I have spoken to other counselors and to folks in the admission world who agree that sometimes when students don't submit tests, there's kind of an assumption that their scores fell far below that middle 50%. So, you know, if a student is within that and their scores maybe aren't necessarily going to enhance their application, I would also rather their lack of scores not potentially harm their application, right? And so it really is kind of dependent on other parts of their application, how strong the rest of their profile is, and then also just where they fall within or below that middle 50%.
So I think we can both agree that perhaps this is a really good question to ask a counselor when a student is considering, because as you're saying, you know, you've had conversations with specific schools. And so a lot of counselors out there probably have some insight as to what schools may really be looking for those test scores versus not.
That's right. And you can look out for an episode where we'll be really digging into this topic exclusively, data and test optional policies. That's going to be on Wednesday, May 1st. So let's move on to the next middle 50%, which is GPA. So it's the exact same concept. So, you know, the middle 50%, you know, below the 25th percentile and above the 75th percentile. But when it comes to your grade point average, so also tricky because you need to understand if the school is considering reported GPAs or if the university recalculates GPAs. So I always worked at institutions that recalculated GPAs, which means that if you are applying from a high school that gives you a weighted GPA, so anything above a 4.0, right, that is weighted based on honors, AP, IB, any kind of advanced course, and you have this higher GPA, just know that many colleges and universities will actually recalculate it to an unweighted 4.0 scale. Now, that doesn't mean that your honors and AP classes, et cetera, don't count, right? They're still calculated within the rigor that's being considered. And so some colleges have like a rigor point scale that they calculate based on the rigor of your courses. But to make the process, the review process, more manageable, as you can imagine, it would be really hard to work with all kinds of different GPA scales. Colleges will often recalculate. So, you know, that can be a little bit tricky, but how can it be tricky? Like, how do we conceive of middle 50% considering this recalculation that often takes place?
Yeah, as you said, I think this is such a tricky number. I also worked for multiple institutions that always recalculated as well. And Tasha, I know both of you and I have backgrounds in international admission too. So seeing not just 4-point scales or 5-point scales that are really common in the US, but working with 7-point scales and 12-point scales. So it was really helpful to be able to recalculate and try to compare as much as you possibly can, apples to apples between students and what their GPAs might represent. So yeah, this is one of those numbers that I really advise students to take with some caution and not necessarily live and die by because of that. I think because of how schools can also recalculate GPAs, it's a statistic that can be manipulated pretty well too. And so I find a lot of schools that I believe report out higher GPAs than I would have anticipated a lot of times. And so I never want a student to count themselves out because of what this middle 50% might think that they or might show and what they might think that it might represent. And as we said, I think this is a great one to ask questions of to the school if they'd be willing to explain perhaps how they recalculate GPAs or how they came up with that number. That can add a lot of really good context for understanding what it might represent for their applicant pool.
Absolutely. That's important to note that there's always all kinds of different kinds of reporting that takes place that you might want to take with a grain of salt, especially when it comes to these nuanced calculations like GPA. That said, you know, we know that a 3.7 unweighted generally is about an A minus. You know, you as a student know what an A minus looks like at your school and should be able to kind of glean a general match of profile based on that. All right, so two factors that we're going to talk about in tandem coming up next that may affect admit rates, and that is in-state or out-of-state admission numbers, as well as other kinds of demographic statistics for admitted and enrolled students. So first up, you know, especially if you're applying to a public state institution or like the UC schools, for example, Michigan, any kind of like highly selective public school like that, they will have often separate admission numbers for in-state and for out-of-state students, and that often affects selectivity, right? So there's definitely this idea that applying from out of state can often be more competitive for some of these universities. And, you know, there is a useful breakdown for public institutions. They often UC has a really, really robust online resource that kind of gives you all that information that can be really helpful. Anything else you want to add about in-state and out-of-state, Kim?
I just think it's a really important number to keep in mind for students who might be looking at public institutions, again, whether within their own state or not. So many of the numbers for a lot of public states are really set by the state legislator as to what percentage of the student body can be out of state versus in state. Of course, being a public institution, their mission is to serve their own students that are within their state. And so, yeah, there can be really dramatic differences. I think, for example, about UNC, you mentioned, of course, the UC system and Michigan, UVA being another one. These are all states that report out their in-state versus out-of-state admission rates, and they can vary dramatically. On the flip side, there are a lot of small states that have really fantastic institutions, and sometimes you see much more sort of equity within those numbers. And I'm right now thinking of a place like UVM, for example, that's been really popular in the last couple of years and has really comparable out-of-state to in-state acceptance rates. And so there also can be opportunity in understanding, again, what those differences might be depending on where you're coming from.
So as I mentioned, there are other demographic statistics that will often be a part of an admitted student profile that a college might post. And that's going to include things like geography, so where students are coming from, gender identity, racial or ethnic identity. And so financial aid statistics and socioeconomic diversity are kind of another kind of pool that we would look at of the kind of statistics that are available to you, often, again, through this admitted student profile. So one of these stats is the percent of Pell eligible students that are admitted or that have actually enrolled to campus. That can give you a sense of how welcoming or supportive an institution might be of students who are Pell eligible, which essentially means they fall below a certain income bracket. And then there's the student profile that colleges and universities will often post after an admission cycle that is kind of a snapshot of their incoming class. So of the class of students that they admitted and that actually enrolled to be a member of their incoming class. And so that's going to give you all of these numbers. But keep in mind, you know, it's really just the students who enrolled. It's not necessarily a snapshot of everyone who admitted, who they admitted. And sometimes there's a gap there, right? Of course, not all students will apply to many different universities and then might be admitted to more than one and then have to choose. And then any of the ones that they don't choose, there's a gap there that affects yield. And you can learn more about yield on an episode from last season. but I want to move on to this next part of the episode where, you know, I want to make sure that students understand where they should be looking for the most reliable data of all this data we already talked about. So shout out to last episode, episode one with Alicia. We talked about trustworthy and less trustworthy resources of where to get information in general. But data is a little bit trickier, right? It's like you want to be looking at the most up-to-date and correct data. So where should students start?
Yeah, my absolute most favorite resource for finding data about various institutions. And it's something that sometimes feels like a hidden gem, I guess, because it's not something that the general public necessarily knows to look for, but it's known as the Common Data Set. And so every institution of higher education out there has to report various numbers, a lot of numbers, in fact, about their incoming class, about admission, about general statistics, all kinds of stuff, to the Department of Education. And so this then is compiled every year into what's known as the Common Data Sets, the CDS. And so you can actually Google it for any school out there. If you just put the name of the school and common data set, you can actually pull up a website that will show you what that has been reported out to the government from that institution. So it's a great way to really dig into some of these numbers that we've been talking about. So understanding the first thing that we talked about, you know, admission rate, but being able to see the breakdown by various rounds. You can see what the ED admission rate looked like versus EA versus regular decision, for example. It will show you breakdown by various demographics if you're interested versus how many different students with different gender identities might have applied to the institution. You can see that and also see what those admission rate looks like. There's all kinds of stuff that's really in there. And if you're a data person, it's really fun just to dig into and also start to compare across institutions. But again, can really help you dig into some of this nuance that we've been talking about with a lot of these various things. So that's, you mentioned before, Tasha, the idea of going to the source. That really is the source. Every school's institutional research office has put that together and reported it out. And so that is numbers that are coming directly from the institution straight to the government and is required to be reported every year. Do you have other sources that you like too?
You know, I really think that that is going straight to the source is the wisest thing to do. That said, you know, they are these kind of complex documents of many, many, many pages that include a lot of other information. What I tend to do is just like control or command F search, you know, SAT, GPA, whatever, so you can get to that section of it. But, you know, that is definitely getting in the weeds. So if that feels overwhelming, you know, you can definitely check out the IBY's knowledge base, which actually has a resource with, you know, as up-to-date as possible statistics that use the common data set to complete, you know, often when it comes to admit rates and different kind of more general statistics like that. But, you know, overall, I think going straight to the source is a good idea. That said, sometimes it takes colleges a little while to put up their most recent common data set. Like sometimes you might be looking at last year's or even 2 years ago. So if you're looking at the most, if you want the most recent admission cycle data, sometimes you have to either wait or the admitted student profile, the enrolled student profile is kind of the most up-to-date data available that might not include everything you're looking for, but will have some of kind of the most basic general stats.
Yeah, Tasha, I am a data nerd, so hence I do love going to the common data set. But I think your tip there of just control F and going to the specific pieces of information that you're looking for is super helpful. And also, too, shout out to our IBYs team because they do a lot of work on the back end for us and share that out as a public resource to anyone who might be listening to this by really helping distill down a lot of those numbers. So they do make it easy for us, and I really appreciate that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we've identified what data we're talking about. We have given some tips on where to find this data. But at least one of my main goals as an IVWise counselor is to make this less stressful, right? Let's make this whole process less stressful, which is hard to do when it's getting more and more and more and more complicated, right? So I think for a lot of us, knowledge is power. The more you know, the more you understand, and the more of a handle you can get on things. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to do with this season, and understanding the data and understanding when it's useful and when it, you know, might be more than you need or might bog you down. So I want to close the episode with kind of discussing which data matters most of the data that we've discussed.
Gosh, we could be here for hours just debating that because, you know, all of this is so contextual and all of this presents a really big picture when taken all together. But it really is hard to sort of narrow that down. I think, frankly speaking, we started out with one of the most important pieces of data, and that's understanding admission rates. And so just knowing selectivity for students to help be able to balance a list, understand what's highly selective versus selective, which might be, or schools that might be more likely for them. But really, as we talked about, being able to break that down too. And so really recognizing a difference between an admission rate for an early action round versus a regular decision round, which can help students think thoughtfully and critically about when they might want to be submitting their applications. And within that too, you know, we talked about admission rates for individual programs within the schools or for in-state or out-of-state. So all of that kind of plays into that really big number, but I think can give students a lot of context and a lot of understanding about how they might fit for a particular school's review process, and also to really help them kind of strategize what might be best for them and how they move forward.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you using that word strategy. You know, I think that that's a big part of the process, you know, strategy while, you know, always being true and honest and realistic and kind of holding true to what you're actually interested in versus upholding strategy for strategy, right? But I do think that to a point, strategizing is important. And in order to do that, you know, the data is really, really helpful. And, you know, finally, sometimes these numbers can be a little bit misleading. And I think we definitely led the episode talking a little bit about that, about how different admit rates are really nuanced depending on the kinds of applications and application rounds and this particular college that you're applying to. So just kind of keeping that in mind. All right. So that actually just about wraps up this episode of Just Admit It. Kim, I want to give you a chance to add anything final you might want to add just about data in general, any final words of wisdom?
Yeah. Thanks for that, Tasha. I really hope sort of the overall message that we've conveyed today is, A, there's a lot of data out there and it's really helpful in terms of having students feel empowered and confident as they move through this process. But also, I think to your first point at the top of the episode is also not to get bogged down by it. And so review it, understand it, but don't make every decision. Don't live and die by it is really what it comes down to. So it's great for context, but, you know, this is such a nuanced process, you know, and so I think, yeah, it's just really being able to balance that as students move through and, you know, still trust your stuff. That's really what's important at the end of the day, too. There's this a lot of transparency, but a lot of things that are not transparent about college admission. And this is, for most institutions, a holistic process. And so we're still looking and hoping for students to be genuine and authentic as they move forward as well.
Thank you so much, Kim. So stay tuned for our next episode in a couple of weeks, episode 3. Data versus anecdotal evidence. So this is where we'll be kind of combining a lot of what we learned today with other kinds of information you might be getting from your peers or the internet. In the meantime, you can catch up on all of our previous episodes by visiting our podcast page and be sure to bookmark our knowledge base for additional help with navigating the complex and competitive admissions process. If there are any topics you'd like us to cover in the next semester, please email us at podcast@ivywise.com. And don't forget to follow us on socials for more resources on the higher ed landscape. You can find us at Follow IvyWise. Thank you again so much, Kim.
Thank you, Tasha.
From IvyWise, I'm your host, Tasha, and this has been Just Admit It.